What's up, Gator Nation?
Good morning, Gator Nation.
You're listening to Gator Nation.
And the Gators have the biggest lead of the day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WUMP.
From the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communication.
3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hi, everyone. This is The Communicator, the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications podcast, where we dive into the latest in media, picking the brains of top faculty and staff around the Gator Nation. I'm Matt Abramson, Director of Media Services with Catran.
Hey.
And Emma Twombly.
Hi.
Today we're speaking with Ted Spiker, Associate Dean of Undergraduate Affairs and Professor of Journalism. Thanks for joining us, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
Or should I say Professor Spiker?
You can call me whatever you like. I think most people call me Spiker around here. So.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, and why you chose to pursue journalism.
I grew up in Delaware, sort of a band nerd in high school. Loved music. Thought I might pursue that a little bit.
What'd you play?
Percussion. Was drums. Did it all. Jazz band, marching band, concert band, in the orchestra pit. And thought I might be a music minor or something in college, but decided to be a communications major in college, and had to take a public relations class as part of that. And the prereq for the PR class was a journalism class, as it is here. Took that class, got my first couple assignments back, and they were just blood red with notes, just crushed me, like everything. And the first assignment is a 30-word sentence. Like, how can you have that many bad comments on a 30-word sentence? So I don't know what it was, but I think it was just okay. It was a challenge. And I ended up getting my first story published in the school paper on the front page, and it was a little bit of a rush. And then I just sort of went in that direction and stuck with it.
That's fantastic. You earned degrees from the University of Delaware and Columbia University. How did your time as a student shape you and your view on the communication field?
Well, Delaware, journalism was not a major. So it was a concentration within the English department. So it wasn't even a minor. It was just, we took four classes, but I got really involved in the independent student paper. Ended up being editor of that paper and really sort of found my people, as we do in college, and just an amazing experience of, you know, trying to do good journalism and working as a group and covering the campus, and really just loved it. But I also knew in the back of my mind that I wanted to teach someday. So that's why I decided to go to grad school. So we don't necessarily recommend, hey, our journalism majors here should go to grad school if they want to do journalism, because you get such a robust education as an undergrad. But for me, I only had four journalism classes. I thought I wanted to teach down the line, and then ended up going to Columbia in New York City. And this is, I guess, a common theme, but it was a 1-year program, the whole year at Columbia, I never felt good once. I mean, I just, the professors were, you know, New York professionals. They were these huge names in New York journalism. And I just felt like I could not do it. Like I was literally getting hammered on everything I was doing. And then here, you know, you think you're this big shot at undergrad. Oh, I was the editor of the paper. And then it just became, it was really stressful. And I remember one paper I got back. It was from, he was the former editor of Newsweek. So it was a pretty high level professor, and wrote comments on the paper. And the comment that I wrote, that I saw, was, "This is muck. Marred by blah, 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 blah." And then I realized, I was like, oh my God, I got called muck. Like, okay, that's just a nice way of saying something worse, but you called it muck. And then I went back and I looked and I realized, I think it said much. Okay. I think it said much marred by so-and-so. But anyway, that whole grad school experience was just so instrumental in my development in terms of being a reporter and writer and those things, because I never felt comfortable, and I always had to sort of figure out my way out of, you know, problems. And I think sometimes that's what is tough in today's educational world, right? We try to have high standards. We try to push you, and it hurts and it stinks, and maybe it deters you from even wanting to do this. So it's this balance between how much do we be, you know, that. But a lot of us have experienced that as that being our turning point. I really feel like that was my turning point, and where I feel like, okay, maybe I learned some things and can do some things.
That's the iron sharpening the iron.
Yeah, at that point. Right. And it's tough in today's environment. It doesn't quite feel that that's right for today's generation in a lot of ways. But it is something that a lot of us experienced as being so monumental in our development.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kat. Spiker, I wanted to talk to you about your college years, and I wanted to ask you if you could tell us more specifically about the skills that you took from your college years as you transitioned to the professional field, maybe those percussion skills of yours?
Yes. You know, so that is, so a lot of things sort of came together, and you look back and you start to put connections together. At the time, I probably wouldn't have put those connections together. But one of the things that we really talk about, so I sometimes teach advanced writing courses here, and there's so much that goes into good writing, so we can't unpack everything. But one of them is certainly the musicality of writing, right? The rhythm of sentences, the purposeful repetition that you use to establish a voice, the difference between long and short sentences, and sort of accordioning between those to create a rhythm, to create interesting writing. So the principles are very similar between writing and music. Obviously different experiences, but very similar. A book that I push a lot and that a lot of our students have to use is Writing Tools by Roy Peter Clark. And he makes a lot of music to writing references. If you had asked me back then if I could make those connections, I probably wouldn't have been able to. But looking back, you can definitely see how that may shape how you think about writing.
So you mentioned getting the teaching bug. Right out of school, you began adjuncting as a professor in Delaware, followed by Lehigh University. Did you catch the teaching bug like immediately? How quickly out of school were you like sucked back into it?
I think it was in school as an undergrad. Like I saw like at Delaware, again, small program, not a lot of classes, but the professors who taught journalism were incredible. Like some big names in journalism, some academic folks, but they were just so passionate about helping us. And Delaware produced some like really good journalists, like in that, well, they still do, but in that era, you don't think, oh, Delaware journalism, but there were some really good people that, you know, still are at the New York Times and all the big places. And our professors were so passionate about helping us. Like one story I've told before is that I had a professor, he was the one who marked up my first paper and just killed it. And somebody, one of my peers was having a problem, like just a life crisis. What am I doing with my life? So they decided to meet at Friendly's. Do you remember Friendly's? Is Friendly's still fresh? Okay. So they met at Friendly's for breakfast because that's, you know, let's talk about it. They ended up staying for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner.
Oh, wow.
So they stayed like 9-10 hours just talking about life. And not that like that's what we necessarily do as professors, but you could see the impact somebody can have on somebody's life just by talking through things. And I think I felt like what a cool life to live, right? That you can be in a university environment with the energy, with the dreams, with the goals, with the students who have all this potential and possibility. And so I identified back then that I think that I wanted to be in a university environment. So adjuncting was just a step along the way to sort of see, you know, how it could turn into a full-time gig.
From 1993 through 98, you were the editor of Delaware Today magazine. What is this publication? What was your role?
So it's a regional magazine, like we have in Florida, different cities, states have own magazines. Delaware is obviously a smaller state, so it has a statewide magazine. More of a lifestyle magazine, but we did good journalism as well. My first 2 years there was an assistant editor where I mostly wrote, did a little bit of editing, and then I spent the last 3-4 years as the editor of that magazine. And so that's sort of coming off the grad school experience and went, okay, how do I put my skills into place? Well, I'm not, you know, covering news like we did in grad school, but grad school also taught me really about storytelling and depth. And what's great about magazine work is that you have the space to tell these just great stories. So I got to write issue stories, personality stories, sports, history, a little bit of everything. So I really was able to be varied in what I covered. But what I liked most is that we could do these incredibly in-depth people stories where it's not just, hey, one interview, we do an interview when we write up a story. Like I could spend 6 weeks, not continuously, but off and on, 6 weeks with the person I was profiling and really do what I felt could be a true in-depth, you know, authentic three-dimensional profile. You know, so you don't hear Delaware Today magazine, oh gosh, what a great place. It was incredible because I just got to do all this and really sort of develop different skill sets in this. And we had a lot of flexibility, a lot of freedom to do all kinds of different stories.
Excellent. And then in 1998, you went to work for Men's Health.
How did you get your foot in the door, in the proverbial door, that is to say, and walk us through your roles you held there?
Yeah, so I knew that I wanted to sort of move up the magazine chain a little bit and, you know, go to a national magazine. Circulation of Delaware Today was like probably 25,000-30,000. Men's Health at the time was, you know, 1.6, 1.7 million. Ooh. And I just knew that I wanted to sort of say, have, you know, play in a bigger, you know, sandbox. And so was able to get a job there. And I don't know why. I think it was probably because Men's Health was part of a bigger company that was actually not in New York, where most of the magazine world was. It was in sort of a rural part of Pennsylvania. It was kind of crazy. These big magazines were part of this company called Rodale. So I think they had trouble attracting like New York magazine folks because they weren't going to move out to rural Pennsylvania. So I think I got the job because they say, yeah, he's from Delaware. He'll probably come up to Pennsylvania. So it's probably one of the reasons why I got it. But that group there for the 3.5-4 years I was there, unbelievable. So creative. I have never been with a group that has been like in the professional industry setting that was just so creative and smart and funny and challenging too. So, you know, again, theme after theme is everything is not just turn it in. I mean, we would do 10, 12 drafts of stories as editors working with writers and everybody always pushing back on us. There are editors above us, you know, pushing us to do better, get better information, find different studies, you know, think of new story ideas. So there I had three roles. I was an associate editor, a senior editor, and then an articles editor. So just sort of kind of worked way up with different sort of responsibilities there.
Was everything just the print magazine, or was like internet articles and posting on multiple platforms starting to work its way into?
Are you saying
magazine?
I'm old, Matt?
I'm saying we're old.
It's a good question because it's true. When I was there, my role was solely on print, and web was just starting to sort of say, okay, we got to start thinking about the digital product. Obviously now it's digital 24/7, even for magazine brands, and the printed magazine is sort of an offshoot, you know. And they've got to think about how do they fill their content, how do they fill their social. But social certainly wasn't around. Web was just starting to, you know, be a resource for people. But so our role was mostly on the print side, but it was everybody thinks, you work for a magazine that comes out 10 times a year, you don't really have to work. But we really had four issues going at once, like one that was going to print right now, one that was about to, one that was getting close to, and then long-term planning for doing the cycle. So it's not like, oh, finish one issue, start another one. It was, you got four things plus long-term going on at all times.
Hi, Spiker. This is Emma. So you kind of touched on this a little bit in the last question, but what was a typical production cycle for an issue of Men's Health like, and what are some digital components that we could expect?
Yeah, it was that where we were just, it was, you had to use different skill sets every day because you would literally, production would put hard copies of pages on your desk and say, proof this or cut two lines, and just very detail oriented. And then you'd have files that were getting ready for the next issue, and editors were like, oh, well, you're missing this information and this information and this information. Go get it. So that's a different skill set. And then you said, well, what's our lineup for the next issue? Like, do we have all the stories in place? Is this good enough? So then you had to use sort of the brainstorming creative aspect to say, hey, do we have all our stories? So you're using all those different parts of your brain really every day, because you had things happening all the time. Because it's not like we had different roles. We probably had 12, 14 editors on staff. Most of the writers are contract, so they're freelance, so they're not in the building. You're working with them remotely. And so the editors are responsible for all of those issues. In terms of digital, it's a little bit different mindset, but same, except for it's just a lot faster. I feel like there's a little bit less in terms of futuristic planning, and they've got to sort of feed the beast and have social content and have, you know, have their newsy stories. So even at Men's Health, we would do newsy story, like what were the studies that just came out, you know. But obviously, we still had to have that information 6 weeks before it got printed. But now you have to have the newsy stuff, and it's got to go up right now. So the mindset is quite a bit different, you know, than doing the print magazine, but still similar skill sets, I think. Yeah.
we know you're influential, but you were also named one of the 100 most influential people in health and fitness by greatest.com. Did you realize how influential your work was and the impact it was having?
Yeah, I think that list was, I don't know about that list. That's kind of weird, you know? But so I think what happened, I know we're going to talk about this, I think in a second, but, you know, after I came to UF, I did a lot of freelancing, you know, of health writing. And I tended to do, I started doing some things for Runner's World. And, you know, I'm not what you would say is the typical build of a classical runner, right? So I ended up doing a blog for them and representing sort of running misfits, people who feel like they're misfits. They're not misfits, but they feel like they're misfits in that space. And I think that became, you know, a little bit of something online and, you know, was able to, you know, hopefully be influential to people and whatnot. I think they also cited that I was teaching health writing classes and helping sort of next generations of health and fitness journalists is maybe one of the reasons why I squeezed in there. I think I was 99.
Since you mentioned it, you've been involved with the Runner's World blog. Tell us about the Marathon Virgin and Big Guy blog and what that was entailed.
Yeah, so my athletic history is basically none, but I always loved sports, I loved the idea of what is the relationship between physical ability and mental strength, right? So how do those collide? How do those help each other? And I never had the physical ability, but it was always just really curious about that. So I always said, okay, I want to do a marathon, you know, that'd be great. I'm going to be slow. I'm going to be plodding along. So I had been doing some freelance for Runner's World and I pitched to their online editor, hey, would you be interested in having a blog about somebody who's doing their first time marathon? So it's not, you know, really an original idea at the time, but I think they maybe saw, okay, you know, you can add a little bit of style and voice to it and you can come from a perspective, hey, you're not like a classic runner. So that became a deal for like a, you know, for a year, and they follow, you know, readers followed that journey. And Runner's World is obviously a huge platform, right? It's a huge platform for the running community. So,
and how was the marathon?
Oh God, I got through it. It was tough. I had a bad ankle sprain about 6 weeks before it, so that sort of cut the training. Not that it necessarily would have helped that much, but I got through it. And I got to do New York, which was crazy because I got in by lottery. Just so it's just by chance. And New York City Marathon is one of the most phenomenal experiences someone can have because it is big and loud and it's moving because it's international and there's so many people lining the streets and you just feel it, right? You just feel it. But I got through. It was tough. It was a long day. But I got through and I was happy to have done it. And so when we finished, you know, some of the online comments were, you know, most of the online comments were very supportive, you know, hey, good job, you did it. And someone were like, what the heck happened to you? That time is terrible. You know, I'm like, geez, come on, give me a break. Yeah. So then after that was over, obviously that was over. And I think, you know, Runner's World saw, hey, you know, there's some following here. It's gotten a little bit of traction. So what can we do next? So I pitched them a couple of ideas. One of them was like Revenge of the Virgin, you know, to try to do it again and see if I could do better. But where we landed was on the Big Guy blog, which was, okay, you're going to represent this set of folks who don't feel like it's their space. And what we really found really quickly was that people, it wasn't because it was me. It was because people identified with the struggle. They identified with trying. They identified with trying to fit in. They identified with trying to hit goals. And then an outshoot of that was I said in one of my posts, I said, you know what, here's my next goal. Okay, we did the marathon, whatever. One of my goals was going to be, let's try to break 30 minutes in a 5K. So everything is relative, right? So for some people, that is like super, super slow. And so for other people, it's super, super fast. For me, it was just like a benchmark that would be a really good goal because I knew that I was not there, but something to train for and if I could get it. So I did this post. I asked people, hey, do they want to join some group where we can all get together and sort of hit this goal? And I said, here's my info. We'll set up a group. And that day I got like probably 150 emails of people who wanted to join the group. So we called it the Sub 30 Club. Mm-hmm. We ended up moving the club to Facebook and it now has over 6,000 members on it. Oh, and people have just made friendships. People have gotten married on that club. Just, you know, incredible, because there have been, you know, in-person meetups, not just they got married because they were commenting on each other's posts. So it became like a thing, and it became like a big thing for a little while. It's sort of toned down a little bit now, but that platform on Runner's World was a really cool experience, because people could share in the ups and downs of your journey, right? In terms of, you know, chasing whatever you're chasing. And it became much more than a 30-minute 5K. It became whatever goal you were having and the struggles and all those kinds of things. So it was a really fulfilling project, you know, over a bit of time.
And on that same note, and for those who don't know, you've competed in the Florida Ironman race. Does your personal fitness journey influence your professional work and view on health?
Yeah, for sure. So just quickly, I don't know if you know the Ironman sort of structure, but the Ironman structure is you do a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, and then a marathon, 26.2-mile run, all right in a row. But here's the kicker. It's a 17-hour time limit. And if you finish in 17 hours and 1 second, you know what they put next to your name?
Disqualified.
Yeah, did not finish. Oh. DNF, did not miss. 17 hours and 1 second. You spent all that time training, all that time racing, and 17 hours and 1 second did not finish. But that's what makes it good. Right? That's what makes it good, is that there's a little bit of a time limit there. So again, going back to my fascination of sort of physical versus mental, I, as a kid, like loved when Iron Man came on. It came on once a year on NBC and the Hawaii one. And I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Well, again, this is my athletic career. Last person picked for my 8th grade basketball team. And I scored 2 points in the entire year, right? Not average per game. 2 points the entire year, and was with 2 minutes left in the final game of the season. So that's my athletic career.
I'm Glenn Richards from WUFT Amplified. If you're like me, you appreciate how special the local music scene is here in North Central Florida, featuring indie rock, hip hop, bluegrass, and so much more. WUFT Amplified is Florida's music series, filmed right here in Weimer Hall. This show rocks, guys, seriously. And you might not realize that WUFT Amplified is produced entirely by UFCJC staff and students. To watch past episodes and discover your new favorite bands, check out wuft.org/amplified.
So I'd always loved Ironman. I'd already done the marathon. I had done a couple of those mud obstacle courses as part of the blog. And then I had a buddy who had done an Ironman. He said, we're going to do one because I know you want to do one. And I said, okay, let's give it a go. So we went to Florida Ironman in 2012 to volunteer. And that's how you get automatic entry the next year. So we volunteered 2012, got the entry, signed up for 2013. So basically it was a year of learning, you know, learning bike and how it feels to sit on a bike for 6-7 hours, which really stinks. The swim I was okay with. It's the shortest part of the race. So I knew that with training, I would be fine with that. And running is just a fight, right? You're coming off 112 miles of bike, and then you got to run a marathon after it. So I spent a year training and just tried to be methodical. I didn't worry about my time too much. I just tried to try to get done. So race day comes. I feel like I'm sort of ready, you know, hope. Swim goes fine. I feel good. Get on the bike. And I knew bike was going to be my weak one. And I get on the bike and everybody starts at the same time. So it's like a mass swim start in the Gulf. And so I get out, I feel like I'm not like in dead last, you know, I feel like I'm okay. Well, I get on the bike and within the first 4 or 5 miles, people are just passing by me. And you just got to stay out of your head, right? I don't have anything else to do today. So I might as well do this. Mm-hmm. And so I got through the bike and then I was like, okay, now I got to figure out a way. I already had a marathon and already was not good in that. So now I got to do a marathon after all of this. So we're already 9 hours into the race or whatever it is. And I get out and my goal was like, I'm going to run a couple minutes and then walk just to get through. First mile. I have never felt this in my entire life. My entire body cramped. I've never felt a total body cramp, like the whole thing just cramped. And I said, what is going on? You know, but I was like, I can't stop. Like, I cannot bail. So I just, okay, recalibrate, said, you are going to walk as fast as you can for 5 miles. Just knock out 5 miles, walk as fast as you can, and then see what you can get. So I got to 5 miles, and then I just started, like, run 100 steps, you know, and I just kept doing that for a time. And then I got to the 13-mile mark, so halfway of the marathon, almost done. I get there, and there's a little turnaround point. So you are here, and people in front of you, you sort of go by face to face. So I'm getting to the turnaround mark and probably a few minutes from it. So this person is theoretically 5-8 minutes ahead of me. Well, his friend or his partner runs up to him and says, because they're tracking times through GPS and all of them tracking mats, you have got to move it. They are saying you are not going to finish based on your time. You have got to move, and you've got to move now. And is saying this to the guy who's like 5 minutes ahead of me. Bleep, bleep, bleep. You know, do you have a bleep button?
Nobody
has actually used it. Okay. So that's what I said. And then I went back and I looked at sort of all my splits after it. And that was the fastest mile I did the whole race. It was like between 13 and 14. But I sort of started calculating. I was like, no, I'm fine. Just keep going. And then so I ended up finishing in like 16 hours and 40 minutes. So I had 20 minutes to spare. Barely made it. If I had had a flat tire, I wouldn't have made it. But I will tell you, it was one of the most, you know, fulfilling personal things that has happened, because it was just like, okay, you are not made for this. You stuck with it. You hung in there and you just tried to fight to get through it. So getting back to your actual question, sorry, I felt like your actual question is, I think so much about health, writing today is either coming from sort of experts and docs, and this is what you should do, and this is it. Or it's coming really from influencers who look the part and are perfect and perfect bodies, and this is what I do, follow mine. But the every person is sort of a voice that people, I feel like, they need or they want, right? It's, health is not perfect. Health has, that you have problems, you have struggles. We do see that obviously in influencers as well. But I feel like my experience, I can relate to people who are dealing with whatever they're dealing with. So it's not coming from a place, I know everything. It's coming from a place, I've been there and it's been hard, and you know, and these are the things we try to do, you know.
It's really a grind for most of us.
Yeah.
So you authored your book, Downsize, as well as co-authored dozens of books centering around health. What is Downsize and what went into telling that story?
Yeah, so I had done a bunch of health books and health writing probably for 10-ish years before that, and just felt like I wanted to sort of combine everything that I've learned in the space, using some of my personal experience as a narrative thread, but bringing in other people's stories, bringing in experts. So the idea behind it was, like, here are the 12 things that have worked for me. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just saying, here's some commonalities. And that was based on research, based on experts, based on anecdotal, you know, stories, case studies, and weaving myself into a little bit of it. So, It was a great experience to do, because I spent so much time writing other people's books. Like, that's generally what I do. As a doctor has an idea, a group of doctors have an idea, they need someone to sort of translate the science. That's where I come in. So it was cool. It was cool to sort of do my own perspective. And the Iron Man becomes a little bit of a thread in there in the journey to do that. So
I was wondering, in your experience, what do you think is the greatest misconception about health that you see perpetuated in the media?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's tough because you don't want to generalize all health media, and you don't want to generalize all people's experiences. But I'll just point on something that I sort of struggle with as not just a, you know, writer, reporter in the health space, but also as someone who has the ups and downs or whatever is, we have all this talk about the science, the research about health, this is what works, this is what doesn't work. And then we have people who sort of tell their story that may be against the grain of what science, or maybe it hasn't been studied at all. And the individual story is so powerful, right? We know that from a storytelling perspective, that the anecdote is super powerful. But is that strong research? The research wouldn't say that's strong research. But human side, we know that it's a really strong way to influence and to inspire. So what I have a hard time is we generalize each area, right? The anecdotes say the science doesn't apply to everyone. And the science says, well, the anecdote doesn't have any science based off of it. So the human body has so many variables. It's almost impossible. Well, it's not impossible, but it's almost impossible for me to say this won't work for you because the science says that it works this way. So we don't, it's hard to say that. I mean, obviously there's some exceptions, you know, when it comes to medical procedures and certain treatments and things like that. But when you're talking about things like, you know, weight loss and health and fitness and things like that, it's hard to say something doesn't work because a lot of things haven't even been studied to even know. So the personal experience is so important in somebody's health journey. And the research does inform that, but it's not everything. And the way I see it is sort of health information is such a cocktail of different ingredients, and people have to sort of sift through and figure out what makes sense for them. And I don't say that in a sort of, hey, just go off and do whatever you think and it's not healthy, right? There's safety and there's other things that at play, but I think it's a lot more complicated than gets simplified in the media sometimes. And because everybody's experience and body is so, we all share common things, but so many variables influence in terms of genetics, in terms of what we eat, in terms of environmental factors. So it's so hard to sort of control, hey, this is the one method that will work for X, Y, and Z.
So, Spiker, in 2001, you came to UF.
Yep.
How did we get so lucky?
Oh, stop.
What were the circumstances?
So, you know, as I said, I really wanted to get into teaching full time. I was working in the industry full time and adjuncting on the side. I wanted to flip those. I wanted to teach full time and write on the side. So I knew I wanted to do that. That's why I got my master's. I knew I didn't want to go the PhD route, which is obviously an important and great route to go. It wasn't me as much as sort of going the industry route. But the problem is that most places, PhD is required for faculty positions. It's changed a little bit, especially with professional schools. But at the time, you know, that's the way I wanted to go. So I spent all my time at Men's Health. I said, okay, now I'm going to just start looking. I'm going to see what's out there. So I applied to a couple and they were all PhD required and they just automatically dismiss you if you don't have your PhD, which is totally fine. And then I can remember opening up, you know, one of the higher education ads and the ad popped up and it was University of Florida teaching magazine journalism, no PhD required. And I was like, oh my God, like this job is exact, like this is me. And, you know, I said, I got to give it a go. I'm from the Northeast, never lived down here, and just had to give it a try. And
this is before Tim Tebow era.
It was definitely before Tebow.
So what drew you to Florida? What made this job, other than the requirements, like, was there anything about UF that you're like, oh.
I didn't know much about UF. Yeah. Like, it was the job. I knew it had a good reputation, but it was like, okay, if I want to get into academia, like, this is the place. So I ended up putting my package together. And I did a cover letter too, but in addition to my cover letter, I made a magazine cover and put myself holding a gator on it and, you know, tried to just say, okay, I really want this, you know? So they ended up, you know, hiring me and it's been incredible. And it's, you know, the students here are incredible and coming from the North, you don't know as much about, you know, other schools, but, just been amazing with the students and the opportunities and the things we do here at CJC. But yeah, it was, you know, I wasn't like, oh, I got to get a job right now. When I was at Men's Health, I could have stayed there longer, could have done another stop on the magazine tour. But when that came up, I was like, this does not come up at all. Right. This kind of job does not come up at all and had to give it a try. So
you've taught a variety of courses here. What do you teach currently?
So, I teach, sports media and society. That's the big lecture class that I do. Love it. It's basically a media literacy course where we talk about all the issues in media, how to understand media, but under a sports backdrop, has all the different majors in it, inside CJC, outside. We try to bring in a lot of great guests from both the media perspective as well as the athlete perspective on how they view the media, how they use their own media. And I'm lucky enough because I'm old, as I think you referred to later. No, you didn't. I'm just kidding. I referred to myself. No, but because I've been around for a while, I've had some people in class who have just gone on to do amazing things, and they're great about being guest speakers. So the classes that I teach now, it's really cool because you bring in people from ESPN, you bring in Olympic gold medalists, and they get the chance to meet them and talk to them. And we also try to bring in current events. So something happens that where, you know, Deion Sanders is arguing with a reporter about something. So now we can bring it up and talk to him, like, who's right here? Who's wrong? You know, what's the nuance here? And it becomes a very relevant, like, in the moment type class, I think, I hope. And it's a cool class. And then the other class I teach usually just rotates. Sometimes I do advanced writing classes. Next fall, I'm doing a class called Professional Creativity, open to all four majors, just trying to help students unlock creative tools and expand their creative toolbox, whatever field they're going into. So,
do you field independent studies as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do a lot of them. So big projects, could be writing, could be other, you know, we try to help students, you know, do what they want to do. And, you know, we try to match the faculty member with the student who's best aligned in terms of skill sets and interests. But, you know, I'll talk to anybody about possibilities and we'll try to match them and I'll try to help them whenever they can.
If you didn't have enough hats already, you're also the Associate Dean for Undergraduate Affairs. Tell us how you balance it all.
So I spent 10 years as chair of journalism and just transitioned to the Associate Dean role. So I'm still learning it. Obviously, I interacted with that role as chair, maybe not obviously, but I interacted with that role as chair. So I had a little bit of an understanding, but, you know, that role deals with enrollment and curriculum and a liaison with the university on teaching and curriculum issues. And we're hoping to also turn that role into, you know, expanding it into creating some different kind of programming for students, maybe outside curriculum programming, outside workshops, bringing in different people and just presenting sort of different ways of learning and different opportunities for students. So hoping that role can include things like that. Spent 10 years as journalism chair, and that was, you know, really fulfilling, just being in the trenches of the department and working with students, developing curriculum, and really hoping to create a curriculum and maintain a curriculum along with all the faculty to provide the best possible education.
So regarding your writing philosophy, would you say you approach each piece that you're working on differently, or are there things that are kind of the same across all your work?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because the answer, as you can guess, is it's a little bit of both, right? So you every assignment's different because it changes based on audience, depending on it changes based on what your actual assignment is. It changes based on the platform for which you're writing. All of those change, and all those are variables. But there are commonalities, and I would think that most of the stuff I do now is in the health space. So what we try to do, what are the commonalities? Is it well researched, right? Is it just, is you have good sources, you have good studies, and then the trick is, how do you make it really engaging, right? How do you make it sort of fun, maybe a little bit funny, without being demeaning to people who are experiencing stuff? So how do you make that conversational and worth reading? So one of our things at Men's Health was, you know, striking a tone in health is really hard, because if you come off as being preachy, nobody likes that, right? Don't tell me what to do like that, right? Nobody wants that. And I tend to think that readers don't want, like, super earnest and super soft and super touchy feely when you're talking about health. Changes on the platform, but I tend to think that. So when I was at Men's Health, you know, we used humor a lot. We used sort of attitude in the voice. And it took me, you know, I was there 3.5-4 years. It took me 2 years before I could sort of get it. But finally it clicked and it worked. But the way they described it was, to our audience, it's obviously mostly male audience, not exclusively, but mostly male, that we're Big Brother. And that just hit right for me, because, like, Big Brother is supportive, but he pushes you, he jokes with you, he might insult you a little bit, but always will care about you. But it won't be like, oh, I'm going to hug you and smush you care. It's going to be like, I got your back type thing. And that, how do you translate that in the writing? It's sort of the approach I take, depending on what the platform is, and it's a little bit different. Like, readers sense that nuance. They might not know how to articulate it, but they definitely sense that nuance and how you're talking to them about serious things. You know,
when you're proofreading, are you thinking about that? I remember hearing colleagues of mine reading emails, "Hi, how are you doing?" Like, as if it was an insulting email, but it's just like as vanilla as possible.
Right.
So, I mean, are you kind of assessing that tone throughout?
100%. Like, you know, the humor is a really interesting aspect. I taught a humor writing class once, and it's just a really interesting aspect. Like, how do you say something that's funny without trying too hard? because trying too hard is really bad, right? Mm-hmm. And how do you sound funny without insulting people, right? You're not trying to insult people. So we tend to poke fun at situations and at life rather than a person experiencing something. We would never make fun of somebody for being overweight, right? That's who we're trying to help. But we might make fun of how we got that way. Like, we live in an environment with where, you know, every corner you turn, you see hot dogs, chips, and blah, 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 and come up with a funny third one, you know? And so you're sort of adding little peppers. You're peppering it with a little bit of humor without overdoing it.
Ooh, pepper is delicious.
Pepper is delicious, especially red pepper on pizza.
Has having students made you look at your own writing or approach to journalism differently?
Yeah, I think when you are in the role of teaching, you are constantly learning, right? So, you know, I think we learn as teachers from working with students and in a couple of different ways, right? So if I'm commenting on something, you know, on how something can go from like a 10-word sentence to a 7-word sentence to make it leaner and stronger, it's just a good reminder for me, because as a writer, I'll just, you know, write and I'll forget. Wait, if this was a student writing this, I would tell them to lean this up like this, is one way. And two, the other side of it is just like, we don't know everything, right? We have some incredibly talented people here, students here who are so inspirational because their talent is like amazing. Like, I've had some writers in class that I'm like, oh my God, like, how do you have that skill set right now as 22 years old? Like, it's just unbelievable. And that's a really good way to learn too, is from each other. I try to think that, hey, maybe I know a little bit from being in the industry for a certain amount of period, but this is also very collaborative in terms of how we can learn from each other. So definitely is awesome. And I think most good teachers would tell you that they're constantly learning. They're, you know, not saying I know everything. They're saying this is a journey that we're all going on together, and we're going to learn sort of in this cool ecosystem of, you know, thought and practice and skill development.
So what might students be surprised to find about you?
Beside the drumming and the marathoning, what else?
So you want to know my college job?
Yeah.
Dressed up in costume for kids' parties. So Ninja Turtle, Snowman, Santa, Batman. I had two really bad experiences with that. One was when I was Batman. It was great because I had rubber abs. I was like, I've never had abs in my life. I had rubber abs. I was like, this is awesome. I always, like, every single kid, when you go to a Batman party, they ask how you got here because they want to see the Batmobile. Mm-hmm. So I always had to say, Robin dropped me off. Right. So I don't know why I said it, but one time somebody asked me, how'd you get here? And I said, I flew. Okay. So when I go to leave, they say, oh, we want to see you fly away. I was like, oh God, bleep, bleep, bleep. Right. So I was like, okay, what am I going to do? You know, my car's parked down the street. It's definitely not the Batmobile. And I have to fly. So what I did is I left. I just got into the middle of the street and I just started flapping my cape and I ran down the block until I could turn the corner, and it was really bad. Anyway, and the second bad thing that happened was, okay, I was Ninja Turtle. I can't remember which one. So the costume is like, you know, thick and hot and the head is big. And like, I think it was a summer party. So I was just drenched. I was just done. And sometimes I would do 3-4 parties in a day. You'd have different costumes and whatever. We gave out, like little kitty, you know, trinket toys in a pizza box, you know, for the Ninja Turtles. And that's what we had. And I get done the party and I put the stuff in the van and I start driving away and I look in the rearview mirror and there's all these colors flying behind me. I had left the pizza box of little trinket toys and my turtle head on top of the van. So in behind me, in the rear view, everything is flying behind me. So I obviously didn't go back up, pick up the little plasticky toys, but I had to go back and get the head. But it was great because it was like a performance thing, right? And, you know, I tend to be pretty introverted until I get to know you. But I do tend to sort of try to be high energy in class, but I think that really sort of helped that, you know, helped that part of teaching, which is performance, you know.
You were also a part of AEJMC's magazine division and also have a background in teaching magazine writing. Do you think print magazine and print journalism will still have a place in our increasingly digital world?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a place for it. It's obviously going to be a smaller piece. You know, people aren't going to subscribe, you know, as much as they do now. It'll be interesting to see what happens when sort of the older generation does not exist anymore and all of the digital natives become the older generation, right? Because they're just not used to that. But I think there are places where, you know, magazines can live. You know, obviously there's some waiting spaces, even though people have phones. I think sometimes people do like tangible. I do think that there are some places for commemorative type issues, right? Okay. If and when Gators win, you know, national championship, there'd be a commemorative edition that somebody puts out and people will want that. Because it's so much easier to store than digitally, right? That kind of thing.
Well, we need them to sign it when they get off the plane
right.
coming back.
Yes, exactly. Right. So, and then I think there are other places too, right? So the magazines that know how to really appeal to their audience and can deliver it in a print product, that print product will still be valued. If they're delivering information that they can, that people can get elsewhere, won't be as valued as much. So if you feel like the product is special, print will sort of still carve out a space.
Are there any magazines right now that are kind of having their peak and their heyday?
Heyday. You know, I think they've all sort of struggled with those monetary questions, but the one over the last couple of years that has had a resurgence has been the Atlantic. Like the Atlantic, very popular, does a lot of, you know, online, but I think a couple of years ago, they doubled down on print and they said, we're going to go super exclusive in the print version. We're going to go super exclusive digitally that you have to be a subscriber to get it. And then they do stories that are so different and exclusive that you'll pay for exclusive. And if it's something that you want, you'll pay for it, right? So that's what magazines have struggled with. That's what the whole industry has struggled with, is we gave away so much away for free that it's hard to say, how do we pay for it? So there are a lot of stories about how the Atlantic sort of bounced back when it came to, you know, came to making it valued, making the content valued. The Atlantic thing just points to having good content, right? That we all have the challenge of providing things that are original and interesting and important and compelling for the audience. But certainly, I think, you know, technology is always going to be an issue, and AI is certainly going to be something that we're all wrestling with and thinking about how can we use it, but how can we make sure it's not being used for, you know, bad purposes, essentially? And, you know, what does it mean for the journalism industry as a whole?
Throughout your career, you've had the chance to interview some notable people. Is there one interview or interview subject that was your favorite looking back?
Yeah, so I've gotten that opportunity mostly through Accent. You know, they bring in, you know, high profile people, and the forum that they use is basically a Q&A. Professor Mike Foley did a lot of them a while ago, and I was lucky enough to pick up some of them over the last, I don't know, 10-ish years or so. And they're all great. They're all fun. I mean, some people are a little bit too prepared, like they know what to do and they know what to say. But some of them are really authentic and really cool. I think the ones that stand out to me are the ones that have like a big crowd and the crowd is into it and they're just feeding off everything the people say. So two of the more high energy ones I did were Pitbull. Pitbull was like rocking, like he wasn't performing, but everybody was just so into it. And the actor Terry Crews was incredible. Mm. Like he really took us high and low because he's funny, but he got serious. And those were some of the early ones I did. But more recently, I think the ones that stood out to me, and maybe this is because maybe I had like a personal, you know, liking. Like I've done a bunch of athletes and I love sports, but they haven't been as like, oh my gosh, this is, but the ones that have been really cool to me, I think, because they had the big crowds and they were also really good content wise. Were Giancarlo Esposito, who was, you know, Gus in Breaking Bad and in The Mandalorian, and he was really good, and this crowd just loved him. And it was cool because I couldn't tell if the students knew him from Breaking Bad or Mandalorian, but I think it was a little bit of all of it for him. And the other one I liked, and was maybe just because I liked the show, but was Rainn Wilson, Dwight from The Office.
Awesome.
You know, such an iconic character in our pop culture history, that just getting the chance to sort of meet him and talk to him, and he was really genuine and authentic, was cool. But the one that really, I know you only asked for one, and I'm telling you all of them, sorry. but just recently, Ki-Hwa Kwan, mm-hmm. right, who was Oscar winner, and he gave that famous viral Oscar speech, was so authentic, and the crowd just loved him. He was so sweet, and he got up on stage after, and he's doing selfies with everybody in the background. And I will tell you that, you know, they get prepped on who's interviewing them, obviously, you know, so they can research me at all. So when I met him backstage right before we went on, I think I've probably done 15 of these. He's the only one who called me by name. Nice to meet you, Professor Spiker. Which I thought was just like, that's such a, like, just such a little thing. And, you know, it was really sweet. And his whole interview was really, really soft and nice and a lot of wisdom for the students.
Well, I know it went viral and all the students loved it. I saw all the posts. I was like, ah, I missed it.
And you know why? Because like he did the selfie with everybody in the background. Uh-huh. So everybody was sort of tagging themselves or passing it around. Yeah. So that was cool.
So for our final question, and I just wanted to ask you, for someone just starting out in journalism today, maybe even one of your students, what advice would you give them?
I think, you know, a couple things. I think one is to experiment, right? I mean, you may think you love writing, but you should experiment with audio and video and social and data, and just try a lot of different things. We had some really people who were great in the traditional journalism, but then they tried coding and decided that was, wow, they really loved being like in the guts of building things. And it was a really cool path for them. They're still in journalism, but doing it in a different way. And related to that, experimentation is just getting out of those comfort zones. Like, you know, like I talked about a little bit earlier, you know, I was a, you know, percussion boy from Delaware who went to New York City to report. I was not comfortable at all. And I think we just have to get out of feeling comfortable, because that teaches us to be more comfortable, you know, later on. So, you know, I try to tell students, hey, it's okay if your GPA takes a hit, taking a hard class and trying something, but like the benefits are okay. Those are the big things, I think.
March to the beat of your own drum.
Boom. Maddie A coming in with that. I love it.
Spiker, thank you for your time. We appreciate you very much.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Bye.
The Communicator Podcast is a production of UF's College of Journalism and Communications. This episode is produced by Kat Tran and Emma Twombly. Thanks to our guest, Ted Spiker, hosted by Matt Abramson and featuring Kat Tran and Emma Twombly. Special thanks to WUFD. Go Gators!